I'll give you what these little codes mean. You know, Roman numeral 1 there, SD is the similarities differences. The similarities differences argument. And then this, the way to read this, this is, I'm giving you some analytical philosophy here, but this is, do you see the SD, then this little mark, NE? That says, if there are similarities and differences, then naturalistic evolution is true. All that's in that little SD, then NE. And then, comma, SD, well, there are similarities and differences. Therefore, naturalistic evolution is true. Can you follow that with me? So,
what's wrong with that?
And now, that argument, that's my... He doesn't put that out like that. He doesn't even deal with philosophy, and I don't think he's aware of it like he should. Where did I put this on, by the way?
We're pausing for technical difficulty.
Yeah, we're pausing for technical. Gotta try it again. Okay. See how whatever happens when you, you know, you may have more than one thing there. But all right, I'm saying that is his core argument, and I've asked, well, how pervasive is it? Is part of, is this page, this part right here, 1-2 here, is kind of my, I'm trying to say, this is why I see this as his core argument. And then I start the evaluation after that. So here's, let's go through this to see. Number one, on the anatomy classifications and what's called the trees of life, the tree of life and his descriptions. If there are similarities and differences, and note my bracket here, in the observable anatomy today between reptiles and mammals, then naturalistic evolution is true. They have a common ancestor. That's the key to evolution, is you have trace all species back to a common ancestor. Now that's page 8. Well then, SD there is just, there are similarities and differences between reptiles and mammals. They're observed, so naturalistic evolution is true. Now that sounds so simple. I think it's subtly simple. And if my analysis is correct, this is part of the trick of this whole discussion.
Is it tautology almost, you know? I mean, would you call it that, or...?
It verges on that because it involves circularity.
Yeah.
You know, it just
verges
like this,
on what was it?
He said tautality. Tautology, is it tautologous?
Yeah.
Tautology is just kind of like defining something by itself, or you know, saying the same thing over and over again. Right? How would you say it?
Yeah.
Using something.
Anatomy. So look at anatomy classifications and trees of life. That's. To me, that's what he does with, he has these charts, and everybody's seen them from when you were in high school and whatever, you know, the chimpanzee up to the ape, to the gorilla, to man, you know, and you just see the chart. That's an anatomy chart. You see the bone charts, you know, with the fish bone has a back, everything that has a backbone, vertebrates. Backbones all the way up to you get to the human backbone, you know, backbones like this to backbones like that, but you see the graph, and he loves reading off the graph. He says, and the graph speaks for itself. The graph does. The graph tells you that naturalistic evolution is true. Well, that's the anatomy classification of trees of life. Then I have more on the fossil record because that seems to be one of the biggest things. And let's just go through it in a couple of different ways. All I'm trying to do is say how pervasive the argument is. If there are similarities and differences in the fossil record between land animals, fishapod, fish-like creatures, and fish, then naturalistic evolution is true. Living things have transitioned from one species into another, and the fishapod, Tiktaalik, we talked about last time, is a missing link or a transitional form. Well, that's just the if-then statement. That's the, you know, the conditional. And then he has, well, SD is the case. Well, look at fishapod. You can hold your distant ancestor in your hand he talks about doing this with his students. He says it's one thing to be studying all this, but when you can hold your distant ancestor in your hand, I mean, you get a sense for the
family part of it, you know?
we're just all one happy family with a fish pod, right? There you go. Hold it in your hand. Well, it is the case. It has so many. Here's about the fish pod. It has so many fish-like traits that we call it a fish in contrast to a tetrapod. Tetrapod's a land-dwelling vertebrate having four limbs. But it has not only differences from some, differences from some tetrapods, but also similarities with them. It has a neck, flat head, eyes on top of the skull. You know, like a fish, see, a fish doesn't have a neck, right? Look at the eyes in the fish, you know. Where's its neck? It wiggles its head sometimes, like, but where's the neck? But, you know, you've got these things that are like in between fish and you know, four-legged things that are tetrapods. They have clearly they have a neck and they move back and forth. Well, then you have the fishapod that has traits of the fish and it has traits of these tetrapods, like in between. Well, since that is the case, similarities and differences between them, then naturalistic evolution is true. Fish evolved into land-loving animals.
That's a tremendous leap, though, isn't it? I mean, I'll grant that differences and similarity does not negate evolution. Yeah, but how does that negate Christianity? At least a Christian claim that God made different things.
Yeah, know? And right. And how are we? How does it prove evolution? Yeah. How does it prove it? You know, that's the. Yeah. But the evaluation I'll be doing more, and expand on that. But
yeah, I mean, it seems like you could line up everybody in this room in order from shortest to tallest, and say, okay, here's the but there's no connection. There's no explanation. It doesn't explain anything. You can't extrapolate anything from that. You don't know anything more about these people or how they're related to each other. Yeah. It seems like that's the kind of thing you're doing.
But here's the thing. Here's the plausibility of the similarities differences argument comes like this. Because let me try to take that back a little bit. I think devil's advocate here is something like this he would do. It does tell you we all have a common ancestor. And you know, like it just like... You go back somewhere, and now we would ultimately say, well, yeah, Adam and Eve, you know, or something. You know what I mean?
But it looked just like us, you know?
But he's going to take common ancestor even farther, and that's the problem. So plausibility is this, and I'll use this illustration over and over again. Let's look at dogs. Most biologists, I understand, and a lot of this I'm going to have to be stabbing a little bit in the dark, but they understand that dogs, all the variety of dogs, descend from a wolf. Like a wolf dog, you know, the wolf family, the wolf species. Well, let's grant him that the wolf is the common ancestor of all dogs. Now, that, I have no problem with doing that. I mean, you know, if the science is okay with some of that, you know, I have no problem with that in this sense. You look then at all the different dogs and you say, the little Chihuahua and the big Collie and all whatever, and you say, the similarities and differences. And then I go from that to a common ancestor, the wolf. Kind of the common dog or the wolf dog, or you call a wolf a dog, maybe, you know, the common pair from which they have all sprung. What he's doing is he's taking that, something that we can observe empirically and study, like the history of dog breeding, and selective breeding and everything, and trace back, you know, to dogs back, you know, how you... And what they do, though, is they move beyond what we can identify, we'll say, empirically as reproductive genetic sharing between dogs, yeah. Interbreeding, and somehow get back to the ultimate dog behind them all. By the interbreeding that we can study from records in the 17th century, the breeding of dogs, and you know, blah, blah, blah. You go back to where the dogs come from, what, you know, and et cetera. What they do is they take this similarities, differences like that, and they want to project to the common ancestor all the way back to the amoeba. Or, you know, back, like, dogs and cats are different, but is there a common ancestor? Well, there's no interbreeding between dogs and cats. You know, so we identify them as different species. But to me, when I'm reading this book, I get this feel, and I hope I'm being fair with him. But that's his argument. It's just because there are similarities and differences between all the species, and you can line them up on this graph, they have to have that common ancestor.
Sort of on the out.
Yeah.
Sure.
If that's the question, if that's the response, then why, if we evolved from fish or apes, then why are there still thousands of fish and a thousand different kinds of apes? I mean, why haven't they evolved?
Well, it's like the evolution continues, but everything doesn't have to change. In other words, there's a biological genetic exchange between fish going on. Mm-hmm. But then modifications enter. They would say now in their storyline, odd things happen, and you have then mutations. They say, and you have genetic in the genetic process, and certain. But yet the population may continue as the certain fish continue.
Okay.
But
I know where to
other
go.
Things branch out, and then if you get billions and millions of years of that happening,
that many,
you know,
that many years, billions. Then if just you know, like if we have a history of a couple thousand years type thing, you're not going to see any differences. Or you're not going to see. Is that things like that?
And that's all to me. That's narrative. See, I just call that talking the narrative.
Yeah.
If you go within the narrative, that you can explain it within the narrative in various ways that to one degree or another has plausibility. But that's within the narrative. But I'm trying to say, well, what defends the narrative? Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, I'm not finding it in this SD argument, but I think the SD argument is his basic argument.
He defined evolution as from the outset as being as, you know, things having similarities and differences, and so it's true by bad definition, but I don't have to accept his starting point. And what would he say to me if I don't accept that the evolution in that differences and similarities indicate evolution? What would he say to me about that? How would he argue that I would have to?
Well,
that
particular point, I don't know because he doesn't defend that point. That's what I think I put up here somewhere. I don't know where I say it, but I note that. It's his main argument that he holds without support. I think I may say that on the next page.
Yeah.
But it's his, on the next page I have, this is something he assumes without support. I see it all through the book. I mean, this is my analysis. I mean, I see him, he uses it in all kinds of ways. He uses it in the DNA studies. He uses it in the fossil record. He uses it in the reading the trees. It's everywhere. I see this as a pervasive argument. But he never grounds that argument. So I'm going like right there, and I'm just saying, I don't see it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to evaluate the SD argument in various ways. And I think it helps us understand what's going on better once we explore it a little bit more. And the evaluation will show why he has to go to predictability and why there is circularity and things like that. I think it comes out of this.
Yeah.
But that's part of as we build, as we go. Some other, yeah.
If they, in the genetic, or the Genesis flood, if they found a skeleton of an aborigine of Australia and in the same deposit found a Mau Mau warrior from Africa, which is 8 feet tall, aborigine being about 3.5 feet tall, they would they assume from that this was an earlier mutant or something?
Earlier mutant, yeah.
That,
well, I think it depends. They might. This gets into other things like dating the fossil things. But the one thing is there, they would do things like how long the arms hang and the nature of the shape of the backbone. and the way the hip bone is shaped, like whether you're a ground crawling thing with your where your hip bone is shaped with whether you're a walk upright. So I think they would assume that those two are both human. Now, whether they would put one as early or another, I think from just today we could probably dispute that. They can be at the same time.
Yeah.
But they do tend to do things like that almost. It sounds like if it's, there is a basic principle here of if it's simpler, it's earlier.
Yeah, that's right.
Because of the SD argument, the similarities and differences between things, the more similar they become. He talks about the bears. He says, the more similar, by the time things descended, the more similar they are, you can hardly see the differences between these two types of bears.
Right.
Now, we've come so far on the similarity side. There's similarities and differences, but they're so similar. Now, the more differences you have with the similarities, then, for them, means that's earlier. And, of course, it goes with the story.
Oh,
you're starting from the simpler, moving to the more complex.
Can I ask
Jonathan first, we have a lot of discussion here, I guess.
You mentioned the fossil record, too. I mean, it would seem a little more plausible to me if you found similarities and differences, and then you dated them through some scientific process, and they actually did line up graphically, like you expected to, based on similarity differences.
And he says that's the case.
So he would say that's the case. So it's not purely similarities differences. It's also you have that similarities and differences, and then you're able to date the fossils, and then you look at the record, and the more simpler forms are older, based on the fossil record.
In many cases.
Right?
Now, you know, the problem with some of that, and this is one of the harder areas for me to go into, like when you get into the dating and some of that type of material. But he talks about, on one hand, we have so few fossils, and fossilization is only relates to certain types of things, and he does a lot of qualifiers about fossils. Then on the other hand, he says, and they give us so much and everything we need. So you know, when you do that, it puts some question mark over the way they place some of these things. And I agree with you that it does seem to have a stronger case. But here's the thing. To me, even within the fossils, if you said this tetrapod is actually in between a fishapod, there's a fish fossil, there's a fishapod fossil, and then there's a tetrapod fossil, right? And say you found these in earlier to later fossil histories. Okay, you've got then the timeline issue and you've got the graph. But I'm still asking about the similarities and differences. And my question is, you have things today that look like they go in water. You've got things that are just in water, things that live in water and land, and things that live just on land. And they have similarities and differences, like what kind of neck they have. They have eyes on top of their head, you know, like alligators, and difference from a fish. Eyes are up here, but the alligator lives a lot in water, but it can also go on land. Then you have things that just live on the land. So to me, in the fossil record, having the similarities and differences, what makes me go any further in my inference by logic than I do from empirical data? They're just similar and they're different, but that tells me nothing about common ancestry. I can't get the biological ancestry between an alligator, a fish, and a tetrapod today. I have no genetic sharing evidence by reproduction or interbreeding. Matter of fact, every test on those shows you can't do it.
Yeah.
And they want to jump that bridge by inference.
But
so
they
it's
want
a
to
similar
jump that bridge after millions of years, though, right?
Well, that's part of the way of explaining how it would all take place when you bring up. When counterarguments come against them, then they need that time frame and everything. But but I'm just saying, you know, even, and this is, I want to test this, and if you have any further thoughts, you know, as we go on and things, I'm looking even, when I look at the evidence that he gives from the fossil record, the fishapod and the one on whales and humans, all I see is there's similarities and differences. They don't tell me that there's a genetic movement from these ones that are really, you have to just identify as ape, and the ones we're not sure about, they look like they may have features of a human. They may, you know, you're not sure about some of these fossils, and they don't know how to identify them. And he doesn't have very many. And then the clear hominins, or the clear human, you know. And all they may be to me is just the same thing we have today.
So you're saying that even if the fossil record, if we grant that the fossil record is true,
for
that,
sake
that
of argument,
the dating method is true,
yeah,
that doesn't tell us anything, are you saying, because, well, sure, maybe we found a simpler form a million years before a more complex form. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that one lived before them. They could have both been living throughout that whole million years.
Right. Because...
We just happened to find one versus another.
I mean, that's very possible. And because, you're just thinking within giving them, for sake of argument, and giving the paucity and the nature of collecting fossils and all the difficulties that he lists himself, all of the disclaimers he makes, etc., I just find that I need more than just that they can lay it out like that in some order.
Yeah.
There are also challenges to that made by scientists, you know, and challenges to the dating made by other scientists and things like that, which I'm not going to get into. But I'm just looking at the similarities, differences argument. Even within the fossil record, I don't see it as conclusive. I don't see it as necessitating. And he just says, see, it's indisputably the case. And I'm saying, how can I can't get to that conclusion from that premise.
Well, there's so much diversity. From a Christian perspective, we can look at creation as they're having so much such an amazing amount of diversity that, sure, we could line things up from plants all the way on up to humans or whatever, because there's going to be so much diversity. I mean, isn't
absolutely.
So maybe
there's
going to
be similarities because of the one creator that created it all.
So yeah.
It's going to have
right.
a divine connectivity to it, yeah.
Exactly, and that's where he here's the thing about, I can jump ahead, that's in my third part three, but when he does the reductio against Christianity, what he doesn't see about similarities and differences is this great truth to me. The triune God delights in unity and diversity, similarities and differences. And he reflects himself in what he has made.
Absolutely.
So we're his likeness, and all the creation reflects the glory of God and his attributes. So similarity and differences between everything within the created world is images God. It's part of the Creator's design. And there's not a smidgen of appreciation of that theological context when he denies a creator and creation, or makes it can't, the Christian view can't, by reductio, it doesn't handle the data that we discover in science with all these similarities and differences and different things that he works with, like, you know, like we're talking about.
Because if he tackled the theological implications, then he would have to admit that he's being intellectually dishonest, you see.
Well, it is, because I think basically it misrepresents the Christian view or the creationist view.
Oh, absolutely.
And therefore, his arguments are straw men.
Yeah.
You misrepresent a view, and then you use that misrepresentation to defeat the view.
Yeah.
It's like knocking down a straw man. It's easy to knock down a straw man, but it's different with something real.
Absolutely.
And that's a logical fallacy of the straw man. He does that, I think, all over the place when he does the reductio. He's doing a reductio argument, his disjunctive reductio argument, I call it, either naturalistic evolution or creation. Can't be creation because it's so absurd. Basically, it's so absurd because he misrepresents it. Sure, it's absurd the way he's stating, but he's not talking about the creationist view.
When he says that similarities and differences negates the Christian view, does he realize that it says in the Bible that God created different things? I mean, he might say that the Bible is incorrect, but it's But he should realize that Christians say that God created different things. You know what I mean?
He doesn't make it that direct. He's not saying like directly similarities and differences are why he would reduce the view to absurdity. Yeah. That's how he defends his view, by similarities and differences. Then he does say we don't account for them properly, and I see that. And it kind of comes out. It comes out in like. I can't grab a quick example right now. I'm starting to get a little bit verging on a little bit, like the way he does reductio is vestigial organs and like the appendix. Well, you know, the designer, a perfect designer or creator wouldn't make someone with this time bomb in your gut. That's what he says. So he doesn't appreciate what? The creation, the Christian view of creation and fall because of sin and therefore death.
But the problem is,
it's not a reductio at all when you realize that we will have that our frame is such that it's subject now to dying and death. Right. A perfect creator isn't going to make that. Well, God didn't make us that way in the beginning, but it's a consequence of sin and the fall.
But what's wrong with his argument there is that he's saying that something isn't true because he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
For example, they say all the times of Christians, you know, I mean, I can't believe in a God who would damn people to hell because they don't believe in Christ, you know, so it can't be true.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, just because you don't like something doesn't mean it's not true.
Right,
you know?
Right. I suppose I'd have to find some other phrases in his work. The distastefulness of the creation view or the creator idea does come out. So what you're saying
Who is he to tell me what is the standard for how a human being should be creator, what's right and what's wrong. I mean,
that's the other side of
he's drawing on God right there. You know,
there's a famous quote, but it really is kind of the Job idea. Where were you when I created the world? Yeah. You know, it's a very arrogant statement because it's like an assertion of omniscience.
Yeah.
If I were God, I wouldn't do it this way. I make that judgment, meaning as if I have omniscience, so I wouldn't do it that way. But God has all the facts, and what he's done is based on that, not our pea brains when we compare. So that's it. You're in part three now. That's okay. I'm trying to formulate part three, write it out more, so we're ahead of it there. It'll take a few more minutes. Just try to, at least if I put on here, I'd like to at least get through this page. B is starting to get into evaluation, which we're doing right now. We're doing some evaluation, but let's try the dinosaur bird in B there. Number two, the fossil record, and B is just trying to show how pervasive his argument is. See if we still have it. See if I'm doing all right with this.
What page are we on?
I'm on page four, and it's B, two, the fossil record, and then part B. If there are similarities and differences in the fossil record between dinosaurs, the dinosaur bird Archaeopteryx, and today's chickens, then naturalistic evolution is true. Birds descended from dinosaurs. Well, similarities and differences is the case. Archaeopteryx is a transitional form because Archaeopteryx and its later relatives show a mixture of bird-like and early reptilian traits. Therefore, naturalistic evolution is true. The evolution of birds from reptiles is fact. Now, you just see my quote there on page 40 and 47. Archaeopteryx and its later relatives show a mixture of bird-like and early reptilian traits. This is that graph again of the similarities and differences. And to me, just look in the world today, and you make graphs of things, like Jonathan was saying a minute ago, but we can make all kinds of greater and closer degrees of similarity and differences between things and line them up. And you'll see, you know, when I get to my evaluation of that, that's kind of my problem here. I don't see how this leads to conclusion with truth and fact.
It's just... It's a logical fallacy.
It's a
logic, poor logic.
Yeah, there it's a non sequitur, poor logic, non sequitur doesn't follow for various reasons.
What you just read there, I mean, to be charitable, I mean, that's really messed up. I mean, that's like saying, you know, if you find a black person, it's Damien's brother. We all don't look alike. But, if my parents' sons are black, right, and you find another black person out there, then it's probably Damien's mom and dad's son. You know what I mean? It's just, there's so many things that that can happen that would negate that. I mean, I don't see.
Well, you see, what they're doing with common ancestors, they're going to just take it back. Like, if just say we did black and white and off-white. What's the other way they do the three races sometimes? But
Asian,
but it's yellow, I guess.
Caucasian.
Yellow, I don't know. Well, Caucasian, Negroid,
Anglo.
And... Caucasian, Negroid, and...
Mongolian?
I don't know what the third one is. Anyway. But you look at a black person, a white person, but because of the common features, you could say, I think there may be a common ancestor. Well, then if you know somebody, a black person and a white person got married, and they had children, and some of them were black and some of them were white, you say, well, there's a common ancestor between the blacks and the whites, and we have that, right? And my understanding from the biblical framework is that Adam and Eve had all the genetic capacity that would... genetic chromosome, whatever, capacity, potentiality for the development of the races, the three, what we call, that similarity with all those differences.
Yeah.
That's all built into the genetic makeup of a common ancestor. So there's a plausibility about common ancestor from similarities and differences. And my problem, as I do in the evaluation, is once you go beyond and below and behind empirical data, like what I just expressed, you have to make these inferences.
No.
Now, does the SD argument, similarities and differences, allow us to make that kind of inference? And there are various logical reasons why it's fallacious.
No.
And that's what makes it a non sequitur, which means it doesn't follow. So, we'll see. Let me try. I don't have to do all these, because just to give the example, let's go to the human one then. Let's go to D. This is the last one we'll do. It's a little longer, but this is the idea of the humans. And let's just try this. If there are similarities and differences of fossils of ancient humans and ape-like creatures, then that shows, I need to make this a little clearer, then that shows a range of traits, or that shows a range of traits on the non-human side that can be put on a graph that shows a range of lesser to greater similarity to humans. See, this is how I'm... Well, then evolution is true. Any is true. Human evolution from ape-like ancestors is true. Now, here's the SD is the case. Similarities and differences is the case. For example, between human skeletons and the skeletons of chimps is the Lucy fossil. That's the one I can pronounce. Which is intermediate between, quote, intermediate between the ape-like and human morphology. Morphology is just the way it looks. It's form. It's similarities and differences. Eh? Moreover, molecular data derived from DNA and protein sequences confirms these relationships and also tells us roughly when we diverge from our relatives. We are most closely related to chimpanzees, equally to the common chimp and the bonobo. I don't know what that is, but then
it's a
little
rock
later.
Star.
Okay. The gorilla is... Now watch this language. So listen to this. The gorilla is slightly more distant relative.
Slightly.
And orangutans more distant yet. Do you see how this is ranging? You've got the human, and then you have these ape-like, and they move in this progressive progression of similarities and differences. Therefore, naturalistic evolution is true. Humans have a biological origin in these non-human living things and display lesser to greater similarity to humans. And so he says, look at this language. It seems impossible to survey the fossils we have or look at figure 25 of hand sketches showing skulls of modern humans earlier hominins and a chimpanzee and deny that humans have evolved. I mean, just look at the diagram. Look at the figure 25 in the book. I have the book with me if you want to look at it. It's just a hand sketches showing skulls of modern humans, earlier hominins, and the chimpanzee, these sketches. And he says, just look at the sketches. That tells you. You can't deny it. Humans have evolved. Well, it's just the, all I see it is another form of the SD argument. I don't want to do evaluation of it. But you see, I hope I'm making my case. This is how he argues through, and this is pervasive, I will say, throughout the book. It comes out in various ways.
So that's his presupposition, basically.
It's basically his ultimate presupposition seems to be, or a presuppositional thing would be this unconsciously held premise that if there are similarities and differences, then naturalistic evolution is true. He never defends that point, but he uses it over and over. He assumes it over and over again.
If it sounds, I mean, as reading this, you know, it sounds like he's after answering the fact that the fossil records show things as they exist today. All right, and it's always been a problem. I mean. Does he acknowledge that when you look in the fossil record, what you find are things as they exist today? I mean, you find
as they exist today.
Yeah,
like well, you do find them there.
Yeah,
but
you find chimpanzees and whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, you do find them there. He acknowledges that, but he's looking at what those other things that you find. You know, this range of similarities and differences. You know, that's the way evolution got started in the 1800s, you know, was from the anatomy charts.
Yeah.
It started from just looking at those graphs. And then he says, well, you know, that was weak in a certain way, and now we have the fossils. But all he did was, to me, you just take the same argument and move it back into the fossils.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get any better.
The great thing about his argument is that it can account for anything that ever shows up. Whatever you find buried in the ground, whatever you find, you can account for it now.
You can't ever.
There's never.
Right.
Nothing is
that's
ever going to go against the view.
Right.
There'll never be evidence against the view.
Yeah.
Because it accounts for everything already.
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that a basic fundamental premise?
It is quite sweet. Yes, that is. He says that's called the falsification. Principle.
You have to be able to falsify something in order for it to be true.
Now he states that principle. He says that the principle is a valid principle, and that's when he's partly defining what science does and how that's when he says, this left-hand, right-hand, he says, science doesn't give us fact. But then, you know, and that's kind of why, and that stuff, you know, and you can always get new data that may change your theory. But then he says, however, it can arrive at facthood.
Or factoids.
Factoids.
Yeah.
And that's in that section where he brings up that principle. So he acknowledges it, but it's kind of like, you know, what this is why it's so tricky. I can't just say, well, look, the falsification principle, you're totally stupid. You don't even know that. Well, can't say that to him. He tells you in the book. It's there, and it's valid. But it's kind of like underneath. What are you doing? What's going on? You know. So
that's the underhandedness of this theistic evolution that really grinds me, is the fact that we have to build into the Genesis account these billions and billions of years so we can make room for this jump. That's why me as a Christian, I need time in Genesis to build this.
Yeah, it was interesting.